Well, I apologize for creating a kerfluffle. that was not my intention at all. I tripped on the top step and crashed. So I took some skin off, that's all. I'm fine. I can walk. My new hip works fine. thank God, it's okay. And had a couple of experts who could bind me up again, so I'm in good shape. Thank you. I could use that. Oh, good idea. So I wanted to talk this afternoon about our self-ignorance. When we talk about ignorance, in Buddha's original teaching, the very first teaching that he gave, he taught that there is dissatisfaction in human life, deep dissatisfaction. Sometimes we call it suffering, but suffering sounds like you fall on the top step and hurt your arm, but that isn't what it means. It means that the suffering of being a self in the human body and carrying a self picture of one around in presenting oneself in many, many situations, and those situations are continually changing, and so the self is continually, in some sense, bewildered because it has to keep changing too, and it doesn't want to. So this is a source of tremendous discomfort and sometimes deep suffering, deep psychic suffering. And Shakyamuni Buddha said the reason of this is because we are ignorant of what the self is. That we have created an idea about the self, a thought, an image about the self, and then hold on to that and keep it, and then develop it by holding on to the things that we think enhances it, makes it look better, makes it happier, feels pleasant, and try to get rid of those things that we don't think fit very well, that are unpleasant, make us unhappy. And so, in a sense, it's talking about our proclivity of denial. You know, oh, that's not me. I would never think that. I would never do that. And yet, it's still like these gnats. It just keeps buzzing at us because it's the truth of things. And so we live in a sort of half world of ignorance of the whole truth of us as a self in the world. And Shakyamuni Buddha said that sometimes in this condition we are really dying to live, really want to live. And in this condition, sometimes we are ready to check out. We just can't stand it. And that is the natural human condition also, the ignorant one, that thinks that the self has to stay in this one way, and if it doesn't, that it's so bad that it should vanish. And of course, there isn't vanishing in that way, because the self itself is a made-up thing. And the life itself never goes away. In the precepts, the pure precepts, the Bodhidharma precepts, it starts out by saying self nature is mysterious and profound. In the truth of the Dharma, there is no killing life. Life goes on. But without understanding it and without creating a life, Buddha didn't say that we polish ourselves up and go to a monastery in order to make everything all better. He said, get a grip on your mind, study your mind, and study how you are in the world. Study your thinking. Make your thinking familiar. And see where it goes. Make your speech familiar. We tend to take our life in a kind of whirlwind for granted. We're being turned by so many different things, that we're being affected by so many things, and it's so easy to be persuaded by so many things. We should go here, we should go there, we should eat this, we should do that. And we're always getting advice. There are judgments out there galore. And yet, if we don't pay attention, we're picked up by all of those things. And we don't know what we do. And so Buddha is talking about stopping and paying attention to what we do. And creating a life of honesty. Not a pure, perfect life, but just an ordinary, deeply honest life. Truly authentic life. A life that is trying not to cause harm. Is trying to be wholesome. It's not trying to be perfect, but just to bring with this life energy that each one of us is, this radiant light that each one of us is, to bring this into action on the ground as a life itself. So when we practice to in Sesshin or in Zazen and are striving, we're not striving to overcome our ordinariness. We're not working to be pure, perfect anything. We're striving to know ourselves and to give ourselves enough time and space to discover what's going on and begin to allow it, accept it for what it is. As I often say, sometimes it's not a very pretty picture. It's not. I think as human beings, we're so new. We might be kindergarten age, maybe, as human beings, if that. And we don't know how to do this very well. We're trying. We're very, very clever at making things, at making jet airplanes and tanks and guns and cars and motorcycles, but not so good at finding ways of being with each other. So practice is about being this imperfect imperfection as it is, completely as it is, carrying a vow to do the best that one can. Simply have an intention. And that itself is so powerful. That itself makes such a difference. And when the intention slides away, there's always something that brings us back. The more deeply we practice this way, the more likely we are to come back over and over again. Ah, I remember. So Uchiyama Roshi said, within Zazen we cannot see if we are enlightened or not. Sometimes we feel clear in Zazen, sometimes not. Is that true? Certainly, we don't feel clear more often than not. In either condition, Zazen is Zazen. We sit right in that place where we can look at both enlightenment and delusion equally. We look and we don't turn away. So this takes a lot of confidence. It takes true trust in oneself. It takes a lot of courage. Courage. Heart. Big heart. And here we've been sitting now for 4 days. And big heart fills this room. We don't sometimes feel clear. Sometimes we don't feel clear more often than not. But Zazen is Zazen. We wear so many masks. We have to be somebody when we get up in the morning. It was fascinating to me when I first lived at Rinsawin for that 1 month with the 12 women that there were no mirrors in the monastery and the temple. And for a bunch of women, that was a disaster. How can we live without mirrors? That's how we function as women. And it was so liberating. It was glorious, right? So, already we carry that. You know, every morning we look at ourselves and we judge ourselves and we identify ourselves, and there I am again. And yet that self, we don't know. We really don't know. We have a lot of anxiety about ourselves. We have a feeling that it's tenuous. We kind of know that it's not quite real and we might be discovered in some way or another. And so that anxiety drives us to put on an even better face if we can. We did a couple of exercises at the SPOT program that just finished up this summer, where people were asked to try to fool each other and try to put on airs and see if they could be discovered and imagine first that they were better than the other person and then imagine that they were worse than the other person and see what kind of relationship developed between them. And it's real different. Just in a little exercise like that, your whole mind plummets when you're the worst person. And it tends to soar when you're the better person. We're just like that. Someone told me a story of how she was serving, and her job at the end of the lunch service was to carry one of the bowls of, she called it spit, that's left after everything is gone. And somebody else was carrying another bowl of spit. And she looked over and saw, oh, good, I've got more spit than he does. We do this. We do. And if we don't know we do this, we're not so helpful for ourselves or anybody else. It creates a blockage between us and others. It gets in the way. And it's based on the ignorance of our absolute identity with others. That this other with less spit is just another person like me. So although often we try to practice and sort of get bigger in some way, practice is about just being the size that we are and letting that be enough. Corbin said, to truly realize what Zazen is means understanding that the world works because only compassionate mind carries life. To truly realize what Zazen is means understanding that the world works because only compassionate mind carries life. And we can feel that, can't we? We can feel when things open up and go on. And we can feel the blockage when it happens. We can feel the no when it comes. And we can feel the yes when it comes in ourself. And we see the effect of it everywhere. So a scholar said, the radiant light of prajna, of wisdom, is each and every person. The radiant light of prajna is every person. Everyone exerts the radiant light in her personal circumstances. This is something that Dogen emphasized over and over again, that this is not a philosophy. This is not a developed scholarly understanding of human life. This is action. How to do and how to be. And it's ongoing. Ongoing in all directions. And it doesn't stop. And so our practice is at the moment where we are to give it full exertion, just as we are, as we are. To be this. We chant the Bodhisattva vows at the end of the talk, and I wanted to share with you the translation that Kobun has given. We say, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. And this is always distressing for people when they first hear it, because it sounds so patriarchal or magnificent, you know, you poor sod, so I'm going to save you. It doesn't mean that. It means the sentient beings in my mind, how I'm willing to see the other, how I'm willing to be the other. And Kobun's take on this is sentient beings are numberless. They will save themselves. won't they? Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Coben said, desires are inexhaustible. They will reach an end by themselves. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Coben said, Dharma gates are boundless, so there is learning and study. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Coben said, Buddha's way is unsurpassable, so it is always accomplished, allowed. So compassion, the compassion that compassionate mind that carries life is about how we meet the other. It's allowing the other and being allowed by the other. There are two sides to this gift that we give to each other. To accept what is before us and to allow ourselves to be accepted by that one. This is a difficult practice for a human being. And yet this is really the basis of the whole of Buddha's understanding. When Buddha was enlightened and saw the star, it wasn't that he had some glorious, fabulous thing that he got. He said, all beings are enlightened with me. All beings are enlightened with us. Are there questions? Kelly?
I know I asked you to repeat this before, that you had one about the Buddha's seeing the moon star. And I think the gist of it was that we should allow the star to enter us.
Mm-hmm.
That you should think about becoming one with
yes.
with what's out there.
And he said he let the star in. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Ellie.
Say that first line again. I'm trying to understand all the
beings are
us. So I got lost, I think.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.
And what it really means is?
Beings are numberless. They will save themselves.
But it's within us, is that right?
Well, one way of understanding that sort of cheeky expression of I will save them is that everything that we know is appearing in our mind, and every being that we encounter is our take on it. So it's up to us. It's not them. It's how we accept what we see. So we can kick the tires and say, you know, I hate this car, or see the car and bow to it. Yeah.
So the next line, the desire part?
Desires are inexhaustible. They will end themselves.
So we really don't have to do much?
Sure, Sonia. Of course. No, it's from our point of view that as far as other people are concerned, as far as our practice in relationship is concerned, the effort that we make is about how we negotiate all of the feelings that we have. And so, of course, desire is one of the powerful ones that drives everything. And it's a survival thing. It's essential. And yet, if we don't have very clear self-knowledge about it, then desire will create havoc, and does create havoc in our world and in the world around us. So desire solves itself in a lot of ways if people are aware of what the situation is and can accept it in themselves and take care of it. And part of that is just trusting the others as well as yourself. Trusting others to work through things.
Like with their own desires?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, we have the precepts, and then it's easy to say, well, that person, is praising and blaming or something like that. And it's not, it's about ourselves. And giving trust to the other, to being working as hard as they can to do the best they can.
Still interested in your opening up aloud.
Well, the third line is Dharma gates are boundless, so there is learning study. And that is the way we are. We have a deep curiosity about things, even though we don't really quite know where it comes from. We often start our thought life asking why. Why is this like it is? And then open up Spinoza or something like that. And the fourth line is Buddha's way is unsurpassable. When I learned it, it said Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vowed to maintain it. And I always thought it was like a road, because we worked so hard on the road here to make it passable, clearing the culverts and taking the big rocks out. And that seemed like, that's what Buddha's way was just working on the road. But then it got changed. Zen Center changed it to become it. I vow to become it. And then Koban had his version, which is I vow to allow it or to accept it.
My mind heard out loud and not aloud.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, to allow it. A lot of practice is, in my life, been digging in my heels and saying, you can't make me. I don't want to go here. It's too hard. It's not for the likes of me, or, there are all kinds of excuses. And to allow it really requires a vow. I vow to allow it. Let it be. Let it be as it is. And we chant it every day during sesshin, and we chant it anytime we want to at home, because it's something that nourishes us and encourages us and keeps teaching us how to go. And we forget, and then we remember.
Well, what I find so refreshing and beautiful about his interpretation is that he seems to dispel that I from the thou.
Yes. And it's not in there in the first place.
Oh, because it's a linguistic.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, how confusing it becomes in English then.
It does. It does. And I've spent a whole week teaching the Bodhisattva vows and trying to sort of open it up so that it can be understood without the I, because there isn't any I in it. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. I didn't quite hear the question. Can you first do
that? I said that what I find so refreshing and beautiful in Kogi's interpretation of the vow is showing that the I that is dispelled or diluted, and so that I that is doing the sitting or the vowing, it's kind of like he lifts the I off so that there's just the beingness.
Yeah.
Pervading.
And in the original, there is no I. Yeah. It's just vowing. Seigan means vowing. And then you have to ask, what's vowing? Yeah.
I was going to add that it's interesting at Zen Center because, like, as a group, we're students tend to chant, I vow, like, here we are. And Blanche is constantly saying, I vow. The emphasis is on vow, not the I.
Oh, yeah.
The speech is kind of the I, so much emphasis on the I.
Well, that's nice. That takes some of the sting off of it, doesn't it? Good for her.
It's Japanese. Is this? Are you talking about a translation from Japanese to English,
mm-hmm.
or not? So this is a Japanese, not Sanskrit. So this is interesting, isn't it? A verb-oriented language, too. Is Japanese verb-oriented? Like,
Watashiwa is not a verb. It's not used. We insert that in Japanese, so we're sort of the translation,
yeah.
It's more natural for English, but they really...
And they don't have subjects or something. When I was teaching ESL students, the Japanese students, they would like leave out the I or the you or the...
Yes, they do. They do. The pronouns are not relevant.
Yeah.
It's the context. And context means body language as well. They have a lot of body language as well as language, word language. So it's there are no pronouns. So it takes off that personal thing. It's a much more social culture. They do things together. You see the lines of them with little flags, and they're all going along, and they're all wearing the same shirt, and they're all, you know, keeping in line, and everything is like that. Very different from us, which we are always emphasizing with the personal, the individual personal. to our detriment, I think. I think both sides are a little off. we can learn from each other.
I was born and raised in Japanese culture, so I can speak about that. Because we don't have pronouns, especially when I go back and talk in Japanese, I often say, who is going to do that? It's sometimes not clear, and it's somehow understood. Or in their mind, it's not clear, so I have to keep asking. So, what do you want to do? What do you think? And I often do
question. Oh, thank you. That's from the horse's mouth.
Coyote.
Horse.
Yeah. Thank you.
The four vowels.
Yeah.
When I say that in Japanese, I don't know how I think about I. In English, it's clearer for me. Like, okay, it's my responsibility to know that. It's very clear in English.
Yes.
In Japanese, it's not clear. It's blur.
Well, it's coming from the Buddhist side, not from the everyday life side. So when you're vowing from down here, not from up here. It's not a thought thing, but your whole life is expressing something. It's not you. It's the whole thing is expressing this. This is what the whole thing is about. We call it bodhisattva vows, and we put these words on it. But ultimately, there are no words big enough to express this force that is living us as we live it. And this is how we, in our feeble way, try to express it. So it's not about me and you. It's about the whole thing. Through you and me. Thank you, Yoshi. Oh, it's after 4. Thank you all.